sardonically with his one bright blue eye. The old man held a wicked-looking pair of gelding shears, which he raised in ironic salute.
"I was going to use these on Mahomet," he remarked. "Perhaps they could be put to better use here, eh?"
He snicked the thick blades invitingly.
"It'd keep your mind on your work and off your cock, laddie."
"Don't even jest about it, man," said Jamie, grinning.
"Wanting me, were you?"
Alec waggled an eyebrow like a woolly caterpillar.
"No? What gives you to think that? I thought I'd like to try gelding a bloodied 2-year-old all by myself for the joy of it."
He wheezed briefly at his own wit, then waved the shears toward the castle.
"Off wi' ye, lassie. You can have him back at supper, for what good he'll be to you by then."
Apparently not trusting the nature of this last remark, Jamie reached out a long arm and neatly snagged the shears.
"I'll feel safer if I've got these," he said, cocking an eyebrow at old Alec.
"Go along, Sassenach. When I've finished doing all of Alec's work for him, I'll come and find you."
He leaned down to kiss my cheek and whispered in my ear,
"The stables, when the sun's mid-sky."
The stables of Castle Leoch were better built than many of the cottages I had seen on our journey with Dougal. Stone-floored and stone-walled, the only openings were the narrow windows at one end, the door at the other, and the narrow slits under the thick thatched roof, intended for the convenience of the owls, who kept down the mice in the hay. They let in plenty of air, though, and enough light that the stables were pleasantly dim rather than gloomy. Up in the hayloft, just under the roof, the light was even better, striping the piled hay with yellow bars and lighting the drifting dust motes like showers of gold dust. The air came in through the chinks in warm draughts, scented with stock and sweet William and garlic from the gardens outside, and the pleasant animal smell of the horses wafted up from below. Jamie stirred under my hand and sat up, the movement bringing his head from the shadow into a blaze of sunlight, like the lighting of a candle.
"What is it?"
I asked sleepily, turning my head in the direction he was looking.
"Wee Hamish,"
he said softly, peering over the edge of the loft into the stable below.
"Wants his pony, I expect."
I rolled awkwardly onto my stomach beside him, dragging the folds of my shift over me for modesty's sake. A silly thought, as no one below could see more than the top of my head. Colum's son, Hamish, was walking slowly down the aisle of the stable between the stalls. He seemed to hesitate near some stalls, though he ignored the curious heads of Chestnut and Sorrel poking out to inspect him. Clearly he was looking for something, and it wasn't his fat brown pony placidly munching straw in its stall near the stable door.
"Holy God, he's going for donus!"
Jamie seized his kilt and wrapped it hurriedly about himself before swinging down from the edge of the loft. Not bothering with the ladder, he hung by his hands and then dropped to the floor. He landed lightly on the straw-scattered stones, but with enough of a thud to make Hamish whirl round with a startled gasp. A small freckled face relaxed somewhat as he realised who it was, but the blue eyes stayed wary.
"Needing a bit of help, cuz?"
Jamie inquired pleasantly. He moved toward the stalls and leaned against one of the uprights, managing to insert himself between Hamish and the stall the boy had been heading for. Hamish hesitated, but then drew himself up, small chin thrust out.
"I'm going to ride donus," he said,
in a tone that tried for determination, but fell somewhat short. Donus, his name meant demon, and was in no way meant as flattery, was in a horse box to himself at the far end of the stable, safely separated by an empty stall from the nearest neighbouring horses. A huge, evil-tempered sorrel stallion, he was rideable by no one, and only old Alec and Jamie dared go near him. There was an irritable squeal from the shadows of his stall, and an enormous copper head shot suddenly out, huge yellow teeth clacking together as the horse made a vain attempt to bite the bare shoulder so temptingly displayed. Jamie stayed motionless, knowing that the stallion couldn't reach him. Hamish jumped back with a squeak, clearly scared speechless by the sudden appearance of that monstrous shimmering head, with its rolling, bloodshot eyes and flaring nostrils.
"I dinna think so," observed Jamie mildly.
He reached down and took his small cousin by the shoulder, steering him away from the horse who kicked his stall in protest. Hamish shuddered in concert with the boards of the stall as the lethal hooves crashed against the wood. Jamie turned the boy around to face him and stood looking down at him, hands on his kilted hips.
"Now then," he said firmly, "what's this all about? Why are you wanting aught to do with Donas?"
Hamish's jaw was set stubbornly, but Jamie's face was both encouraging and adamant. He punched the boy gently on the shoulder, getting a tiny smile in response.
"Come on, Dunya," Jamie said softly. "You know I will not tell anyone. Have you done something foolish?"
A faint flush came up on the boy's fair skin.
"No. At least, no. Well, maybe a bit foolish."
After a bit more encouragement, the story came out, reluctantly at first, then in a tumbling flood of confession. He'd been out on his pony, riding with some of the other boys the day before. Several of the older lads had started competing to see who could jump his horse over a higher obstacle. Jealously admiring them, Hamish's better judgment was finally overcome by bravado, and he had tried to force his fat little pony over a stone fence. Lacking both ability and interest, the pony had come to a dead stop at the fence, tossing young Hamish over his head, over the fence, and ignominiously into a nettle patch on the other side. Stung both by nettles and by the hoots of his comrades, Hamish was determined to come out today on a proper horse, as he put it.
"They wouldna laugh if I came out on Donas," he said, envisioning the scene with grim relish.
"No, they wouldna laugh," Jamie agreed. "They'd be too busy picking up the pieces."
He eyed his cousin, shaking his head slowly.
"I'll tell you, lad. It takes courage and sense to make a good rider. You've the courage, but the sense is a wee bit lacking yet."
He put a consoling arm round Hamish's shoulders, drawing him down toward the end of the stable.
"Come along, man. Help me fork the hay, and we'll get you acquainted with Coor. You're right. You should have a better horse if you're ready, but it isn't necessary to kill yourself to prove it."
Glancing up into the loft as he passed, he raised his eyebrows and shrugged helplessly. I smiled and waved down at him, telling him to go ahead. It was all right. I watched them as Jamie took an apple from the basket of windfalls kept near the door. Fetching a pitchfork from the corner, he led Hamish back to one of the centre stalls.
"Here, cuz," he said, pausing.
He whistled softly through his teeth, and a wide-browed bay horse put its head out, blowing through its nostrils. The dark eyes were large and kind, and the ears had a slight forward cock that gave the horse an expression of friendly alertness.
"Now then, Coor, kamar a hau."
Jamie patted the sleek neck firmly and scratched the cocked ears.
"Come on up," he said, motioning to his small cousin. "That's it, next to me. Near enough he can smell you. Horses like to smell you."
"I know."
Hamish's high voice was scornful. He barely reached the horse's nose, but reached up and patted. He stood his ground as the big head came down and sniffed interestedly around his ear, waffling in his hair.
"Give me an apple," he said to Jamie, who obliged.
The soft velvet lips plucked the fruit delicately out of Hamish's palm and flicked it back between the huge molars, where it vanished with a juicy crunch. Jamie watched approvingly.
"Aye, you'll get on fine. Go on and make friends, then, while I finish feeding the others. Then you can take him out to ride."
"By myself?"
Hamish asked eagerly. Coor, whose name meant foam, was a good-tempered but a sound, spirited 14-hand gelding, nonetheless, and a far cry from the brown pony.
twice round the paddock with me watching you. And if you dinna fall off or jerk his mouth, you can take him by yourself. No jumping him till I say, though. The long back bent gleaming in the warm dusk of the stable as Jamie caught up a forkful of hay from the pile in one corner and carried it to one of the stalls. He straightened and smiled at his cousin. "Give me one of those, will you?" He leaned the fork against a stall and bit into the proffered fruit. The two stood companionably eating, leaning side by side against the stable wall. When he finished, Jamie handed the core to a nuzzling sorrel and fetched his fork again. Hamish followed him down the aisle, chewing slowly.
"I've heard my father was a good rider," Hamish offered tentatively after a moment's silence. Before he couldn't anymore.
Jamie shot a swift glance at his cousin, but finished pitching hay into the sorrel's stall before speaking. When he did, he answered the thought rather than the words.
"I never saw him ride, but I'll tell you, lad, I hope never to need as much courage as Colum has."
I saw Hamish's gaze rest curiously on Jamie's scarred back, but he said nothing. After a second apple, his thoughts appeared to have shifted to another topic.
"Rupert said you had to get married," he remarked through a mouthful of apple.
"I wanted to get married," Jamie said firmly, replacing the pitchfork against the wall.
"Oh, well, good,"
Hamish said uncertainly, as though disconcerted by this novel idea.
"I only wondered, do you mind?"
"Mind what?"
Seeing that this conversation might take a while, Jamie sat down on a bale of hay. Hamish's feet didn't quite reach the floor, or he might have shuffled them. Instead, he drummed his heels lightly against the firm-packed hay.
"Do you mind being married?" he said, staring at his cousin. "Getting into bed every night with a lady, I mean."
"No," said Jamie. "No. In fact, it's very pleasant."
Hamish looked doubtful.
"I dinna think I should like it much. But then all the girls I knew are skinny as sticks, and they smell of barley water. The Lady Clare...
your lady, I mean," he added hastily, as though wishing to avoid confusion.
She looks as though she'd be nicer to sleep with. Soft, I mean."
Jamie nodded.
"Aye, that's true. Smells all right, too," he offered.
Even in the dim light, I could see a small muscle twitching near the corner of his mouth, and knew he didn't dare look up in the direction of the loft. There was a long pause.
"How do you know?"
Hamish said.
"Know what?"
"Which is the right lady to get married to?"
the boy said impatiently.
"Oh!"
Jamie rocked back and settled himself against the stone wall, hands behind his head.
"I asked my own da that once," he said. "He said you just ken, and if you dinna ken, then she's no the right lassie."
"Mm-hmm." This seemed a less than satisfactory explanation, to judge from the expression on the small, freckle-spattered face. Hamish sat back, consciously aping Jamie's posture. His stockinged feet stuck out over the edge of the hay bale. Small as he was, his sturdy frame gave promise of some day matching his cousin's. The set of the square shoulders and the tilt of the solid, graceful skull were nearly identical.
"Where's your shoon, then?" Jamie asked accusingly. "You'll know I left them in the pasture again. Your mother will box your ears for you if you've lost them."
Hamish shrugged this off as a threat of no importance. Clearly, there was something of more importance on his mind.
"John," he started, wrinkling his sandy brows in thought. "John says..."
"John the stable lad, John the cook boy, or John Cameron?" Jamie asked.
"The stable lad."
Hamish waved a hand, pushing away the distraction.
"He said, about getting married."
"Hmm?"
Jamie made an encouraging noise, keeping his face tactfully turned away. Rolling his eyes upward, his glance met mine as I peered over the edge. I grinned down at him, causing him to bite his lip to keep from grinning back. Hamish drew a deep breath and let it out in a rush, propelling his words like a burst of birdshot.
"He said you must serve a lass like a stallion does a mare, and I didn't believe him, but is it true?"
I bit my finger hard to keep from laughing out loud. Not so fortunately placed, Jamie dug his fingers into the fleshy part of his leg, turning as red in the face as Hamish. They looked like two tomatoes set side by side on a hay bale for judging at a county vegetable show.
In a way, he said,
sounding strangled. Then he got a grip on himself.
"Yes," he said firmly. "Yes, you do."
Hamish cast a half-horrified glance into the nearby stall, where the bay gelding was relaxing, a foot or so of reproductive equipment protruding from its sheath. He glanced doubtfully down into his lap then, and I stuffed a handful of fabric into my mouth as far as it would go.
"There's some difference again," Jamie went on.
The rich colour was beginning to fade from his face, though there was still an ominous quiver around his mouth.
"For one thing, it's more gentle."
"You dinna bite them on the neck, then?"
Hamish had the serious, intent expression of one taking careful notes.
"To make them keep still?"
No. Not customarily, anyway.
Exercising his not inconsiderable willpower, Jamie faced up manfully to the responsibilities of enlightenment.
"There's another difference as well," he said,
carefully not looking upward.
"You may do it face to face instead of from the back, as the lady prefers."
"The lady?"
Hamish seemed dubious about this.
"I think I'd rather do it from the back. I don't think I'd like to have anyone looking at me while I did something like that." "Is it hard?"
he inquired.
"Is it hard to keep from laughing?"
I was still thinking about Jamie and Hamish when I came to bed that night. I turned down the thick quilt, smiling to myself. There was a cool draught from the window, and I looked forward to crawling under the quilts and nestling against Jamie's warmth. Impervious to cold, he seemed to carry a small furnace within himself, and his skin was always warm, sometimes almost hot, as though he burned more fiercely in answer to my own cool touch. I was still a stranger and an outlander, but no longer a guest at the castle. While the married women seemed somewhat friendlier, now that I was one of them, the younger girls seemed strongly to resent the fact that I had removed an eligible young bachelor from circulation. In fact, noting the number of cold glances and behind-the-hand remarks, I rather wondered just how many of the castle maidens had found their way into a secluded alcove with Jamie McTavish during his short residency. McTavish no longer, of course. Most of the castle inhabitants had always known who he was, and whether I was an English spy or not, I now knew of necessity as well. So he became Fraser publicly, and so did I. It was as Mistress Fraser that I was welcomed into the room above the kitchen, where the married women did their sewing and rocked their babies, exchanging bits of mother-lore and eyeing my own waistline with frank appraisal. Because of my earlier difficulties in conceiving, I hadn't considered the possibility of pregnancy when I agreed to marry Jamie, and I waited in some apprehension until my monthly occurred on time. My feelings this time were entirely of relief, with none of the sadness that usually accompanied it. My life was more than complicated enough at the moment, without introducing a baby into it. I thought that Jamie perhaps felt a small twinge of regret, though he also professed himself relieved. Fatherhood was a luxury that a man in his position could ill afford. The door opened, and he came in, still rubbing his head with the linen towel, water droplets from his wet hair darkening his shirt.
"Where have you been?"
I asked in astonishment. Luxurious as Leoch might be in contrast to the residences of village and croft, It didn't boast any bathing facilities beyond a copper tub that Colum used to soak his aching legs, and a slightly larger one used by such ladies as thought the labour involved in filling it worth the privacy. All other washing was done either in bits, using basin and ewer, or outside, either in the loch or in a small stone-floored chamber off the garden, where the young women were accustomed to stand naked and let their friends throw buckets of water over them. "In the loch," he answered, hanging the damp towel neatly over the windowsill. "Someone," he said grimly, "left the stall door ajar, and the stable door as well, and Cur had a wee swim in the twilight."
"Oh, so that's why you weren't at supper. But horses don't like to swim, do they?" I asked.
He shook his head, running his fingers through his hair to dry it.
"No, they don't. But they're just like folk, you can. All different. And Cur is fond of the young water plants. He was down nibbling by the water's edge when a pack of dogs from the village came along and chased him into the loch. I had to run them off and then go in after him. Wait till I get my hands on wee Hamish," he said with grim intent. "I'll teach him to leave gates ajar."
"Are you going to tell Colum about it?" I asked, feeling a qualm of sympathy for the culprit.
Jamie shook his head, groping in his sporran. He drew out a roll and a chunk of cheese, apparently filched from the kitchens on his way up to the chamber.
"No," he said. "Colum's fair strict with the lad. If he heard he'd been so careless, he'd not let him ride for a month. Not that he could, after the thrashing he'd get. Lord, I'm starving."
He bit ferociously into the roll, scattering crumbs.
"Don't get into bed with that," I said, sliding under the quilts myself.
"What are you planning to do to Hamish, then?" He swallowed the remainder of the roll and smiled at me.
"Dinna worry. I'm going to row him out on the loch just before supper tomorrow and toss him in. By the time he makes it to shore and dries off, supper will be over."
He finished the cheese in three bites and unashamedly licked his fingers.
"Let him go to bed wet and hungry and see how he likes it," he concluded darkly.
He peered hopefully in the drawer of the desk where I sometimes kept apples or other small bits of food. There was nothing there tonight, though, and he shut the drawer with a sigh.
"I suppose I'll live till breakfast," he said philosophically.
He stripped rapidly and crawled in next to me, shivering. Though his extremities were chilled from his swim in the icy loch, his body was still blissfully warm.
"You're nice to crudle with," he murmured, doing what I assumed was crudling. "You smell different. Been digging plants today?"
"No," I said, surprised. "I thought it was you. The smell, I mean."
It was a tangy, herbal smell, not unpleasant, but unfamiliar.
"I smell like fish," he observed, sniffing the back of his hand. "And wet horse." "No,"
he leaned closer, inhaling.
"No, it isna you either, but it's close by."
He slid out of bed and turned back the quilts, searching. We found it under my pillow.
"What on earth?"
I picked it up and promptly dropped it.
"Ouch! It has thorns!"
It was a small bundle of plants, plucked up roughly by the roots, and bound together with a bit of black thread. The plants were wilted, but a pungent smell still rose from the drooping leaves. There was one flower in the bouquet, a crushed primrose whose thorny stem had pricked my thumb. I sucked the offended digit, turning the bundle over more cautiously with my other hand. Jamie stood still, staring down at it for a moment. Then he suddenly picked it up and, crossing to the open window, flung it out into the night. Returning to the bed, he energetically brushed the crumbs of earth from the plant's roots into the palm of his hand and threw them out after the bundle. He closed the window with a slam and came back, dusting his palms.
"It's gone," he said unnecessarily.
He climbed back into bed.
"Come back to bed, Sassenach."
"What was it?" I asked, climbing in beside him.
"A joke, reckon," he said. A nasty one, but only a joke.
He raised himself on one elbow and blew out the candle.
Come here, Madunya, he said. I'm cold.
Despite the unsettling ill wish, I slept well, secure in the dual protection of a bolted door and Jamie's arms. Toward dawn, I dreamed of grassy meadows filled with butterflies. Yellow, brown, white, and orange, they swirled around me like autumn leaves, lighting on my head and shoulders, sliding down my body like rain, the tiny feet tickling on my skin, and the velvet wings beating like faint echoes of my own heart. I floated gently to the surface of reality and found that the butterfly feet against my stomach were the flaming tendrils of Jamie's soft red thatch, and the butterfly trapped between my thighs was his tongue.
Mmm, I said some time later. Well, that's all very well for me, but what about you? About 3/4 of a minute, if you keep on in that fashion, he said, putting my hand away with a grin. But I'd rather take my time over it. I'm a slow and canny man by nature, do you see? Might I ask the favour of your company for this evening, mistress?
You might, I said.
I put my arms behind my head and fixed him with a half-lidded look of challenge.
If you mean to tell me that you're so decrepit you can't manage more than once in a day any more.
He regarded me narrowly from his seat on the edge of the bed. There was a sudden flash of white as he lunged, and I found myself pressed deep into the feather bed.
"I will," he said, into the tangles of my hair. "You'll no see I didn't warn you."
2.5 minutes later, he groaned and opened his eyes. He scrubbed his face and head vigorously with both hands, making the shorter ends stick up like quills. Then, with a muffled Gaelic oath, he slid reluctantly out from under the blankets and began to dress, shivering in the chilly morning air.
"I don't suppose," I asked hopefully, "that you could tell Alec you're sick and come back to bed."
He laughed and bent to kiss me before groping under the bed for his stockings.
"Would that I could, Sasnach. I doubt much short of pox, plague, or grievous bodily harm would answer as an excuse, though. If I weren't bleeding, old Alec would be up here in a trice dragging me off my deathbed to help with the warming."
I eyed his graceful long calves as he pulled a stocking up neatly and folded the top.
"Grievous bodily harm, eh? I might manage something along those lines," I said darkly.
He grunted as he reached across for the other stocking.
"Well, watch where you toss your elf darts, Sasnach."
He tried a lewd wink, but wound up squinting at me instead.
"Aim too high, and I'll be no good to you, either."
I arched one eyebrow and snuggled back under the quilts.
"Not to worry. Nothing above the knee, I promise."
He patted one of my rounder bulges and left for the stables, singing rather loudly the air from Up Among the Heather. The refrain floated back from the stairwell.
"Sitting wee a wee girl holding on my knee when a bumblebee stung me weel above the knee. Up among the heather at the head o' Bennykee."
He was right, I decided. He didn't have any ear for music. I relapsed temporarily into a state of satisfied somnolence, but roused myself shortly to go down for breakfast. Most of the castle inhabitants had eaten and gone to their work already. Those still in the hall greeted me pleasantly enough. There were no sidelong looks, no expressions of veiled hostility, of someone wondering how well their nasty little trick had worked. But I watched the faces nonetheless. The morning was spent alone in the garden and fields with my basket and digging stick. I was running short of some of the most popular herbs. Generally, the village people went to Gilas Duncan for help, but there had been several patients from the village turning up of late in my dispensary, and the traffic in nostrums had been heavy. Maybe her husband's illness was keeping her too busy to care for her regular customers. I spent the latter part of the afternoon in my dispensary. There were few patients to be seen, only a case of persistent eczema, a dislocated thumb, and a kitchen boy who had spilled a pot of hot soup down one leg. Having dispensed ointment of your root and blue flag, and reset and bound the thumb, I settled down to the task of pounding some very aptly named stone root in one of the late beaten's smaller mortars. It was tedious work, but well suited to this sort of lazy afternoon. The weather was fair, and I could see blue shadows lengthening under the elms to the west when I stood on my table to peer out. Inside, the glass bottles gleamed in orderly ranks, neat stacks of bandages and compresses in the cupboards next to them. The apothecary's cabinet had been thoroughly cleaned and disinfected, and now held stores of dried leaves, roots and fungi, neatly packed in cotton gauze bags. I took a deep breath of the sharp, spicy odours of my sanctum and let it out in a sigh of contentment. Then I stopped pounding and set the pestle down. I was contented, I realised with a shock. Despite the myriad uncertainties of life here, despite the unpleasantness of the ill-wish, despite the small, constant ache of missing Frank, I was, in fact, not unhappy. Quite the contrary. I felt immediately ashamed and disloyal. How could I bring myself to be happy when Frank must be demented with worry? Assuming that time was, in fact, continuing without me, and I couldn't see why it wouldn't, I must have gone missing for upwards of 4 months. I imagined him searching the Scottish countryside, calling the police, waiting for some sign, some word of me. By now, he must nearly have given up hope and be waiting, instead, for word that my body had been found. I set down the mortar and paced up and down the length of my narrow room, rubbing my hands on my apron in a spasm of guilty sorrow and regret. I should have got away sooner. I should have tried harder to return. But I had, I reminded myself. I had tried repeatedly. And look what had happened. Yes, look. I was married to a Scottish outlaw, the both of us hunted by a sadistic captain of dragoons and living with a lot of barbarians who would as soon kill Jamie as look at him if they thought him a threat to their precious clan succession. And the worst of it all was that I was happy. I sat down, staring helplessly at the array of jars and bottles. I had been living day to day since our return to Leoch, deliberately suppressing the memories of my earlier life. Deep down, I knew that I must soon make some kind of decision, but I had delayed, putting off the necessity from day to day and hour to hour, burying my uncertainties in the pleasures of Jamie's company and his arms. There was a sudden bumping and cursing out in the corridor, and I rose hastily and went to the door, just in time to see Jamie himself stumble in, supported by the bowed form of old Alec McMahon on one side, and the earnest but spindly efforts of one of the stable lads on the other. He sank onto my stool, left foot outstretched, and grimaced unpleasantly at it. The grimace seemed to be more of annoyance than pain, so I knelt to examine the offending appendage with relatively little concern. "Mild strain," I said, after a cursory inspection. "What did you do?"
"Fell off," Jamie said succinctly.
"Off the fence?" I asked, teasing. He glowered.
"No, off Donus."
"You were riding that thing?" I asked incredulously. "In that case, you're lucky to get off with a strained ankle." I fetched a length of bandage and began to wrap the joint.
"Well, it wasn't so bad as all that," said old Alec judiciously. "In fact, lad, ye were doing quite well wi' him for a bit."
"I know I was," snapped Jamie, gritting his teeth as I pulled the bandage tight.
"A bee stung him."
The bushy brows lifted.
"Oh, that was it. Beast acted like he'd been struck wi' an elf dart," he confided to me. "Went straight up in the air on all fours and came down again, then went stark staring mad all over the pen like a bumblebee in a jar." "Yon wee laddie stuck on too," he said, nodding at Jamie, who invented a new unpleasant expression in response.
until the big yellow fiend went over the fence.
Over the fence? Where is he now? I asked, standing up and dusting my hands.
Halfway back to hell, I expect,
said Jamie, putting his foot down and trying his weight gingerly on it.
And welcome to stay there.
Wincing, he sat back.
I doubt the deal's got much use for a half-broke stallion, observed Alec, being able to turn himself into a horse when needed.
Perhaps that's who Donus really is, I suggested, amused.
I wouldn't have doubt it,
said Jamie, still smarting, but beginning to recover his usual good humour.
The deal's customarily a black stallion, though, as he knew.
Oh, aye, said Alec,
a great black stallion that travels as fast as the thought between a man and a maid.
He grinned genially at Jamie and rose to go.
And speaking of that, he said, with a wink at me, I'll no expect you in the stables tomorrow. Keep to your bed, laddie, and rest.
Why is it, I demanded, looking after the crusty old horse master, that everyone seems to assume we've no more on our minds than to get into bed with each other? Jamie tried his weight on the foot again, bracing himself on the counter.
For one thing, we've been married less than a month, he observed. For another...
He looked up and grinned, shaking his head.
I've told you before, Sassenach, everything you think shows on your face.
Bloody hell, I said. Aside from a quick trip to the dispensary to check for emergencies, I spent the next morning ministering to the rather demanding needs of my solitary patient. You are supposed to be resting, I said reprovingly at one point.
I am. Well, my ankle is resting, at least. See?
A long, unstocking shin thrust up into the air and a bony, slender foot waggled back and forth. It stopped abruptly in mid-waggle with a muffled ouch from its owner. He lowered it and tenderly massaged the still puffy ankle. That'll teach you, I said, swinging my own legs out from under the blankets. Come along now. You've been frousting in bed quite long enough. You need fresh air. He sat up, hair falling over his face.
I thought you said it was rest I needed.
You can rest in the fresh air. Get up. I'm making up the bed. Amid complaints about my general unfeelingness and lack of consideration for a gravely injured man, he got dressed and sat long enough for me to bind up the weak ankle before his natural exuberance asserted itself.
It's a bit soft out, he said,
with a glance through the casement, where the mild drizzle had just decided to buckle down to it and become a major downpour.
Let's go up to the roof.
The roof? Oh, to be sure. I couldn't think of a better prescription for a strained ankle than climbing 6 flights of stairs.
5. Besides, I've a stick.
He produced the stick in question, an aged hawthorn club, from behind the door with a triumphant flourish. Wherever did you get that? I inquired, examining it. At closer range, it was even more battered. A 3-foot length of chipped hardwood, age-hardened as a diamond.
Alec lent it me. He uses it on the mules, wraps them twixt the eyes with it to make them pay attention.
Sounds very effective, I said, eyeing the scuffed wood. I must try it sometime.
On you.
We emerged at last in a small sheltered spot just under the overhang of the slate roof. A low parapet guarded the edge of this small lookout.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Despite the gusty rain, the view from the roof was magnificent. We could see the broad silver sweep of the loch and the towering crags beyond thrusting into the solid grey of the sky like ridged black fists. Jamie leaned on the parapet, taking the weight from his injured foot.
Aye, it is. I used to come up here sometimes, when I was at the castle before.
He pointed across the loch, dimpling under the beat of the rain.
Do you see the notch there, between those two crags?
In the mountains? Yes.
That's the way to Lallybroch.
when I'd feel lonely for my home. Sometimes I'd come up here and look that way. I'd imagine flying like a corby across that pass, and the look of the hills and the fields falling down the other side of the mountain, and the manor house at the end of the valley. I touched him gently on the arm. "Do you want to go back, Jamie?" He turned his head and smiled down at me.
"Well, I've been thinking of it.
I don't know if I want to precisely, but I think we must. I can't say what we'll find there, Sasnach. But, aye, I'm wed now. You're Lady of Broch Tuorach. Outlaw or no, I need to go back, even if just long enough to set things straight."
I felt a thrill, compounded of relief and apprehension, at the thought of leaving Leoch and its assorted intrigues.
"When will we go?"
He frowned, drumming his fingers on the parapet. The stone was dark and slick with rain.
"Well, I think we must wait for the Duke to come. It's possible that he might see his way to doing Colm a favour by taking up my case. If he cannot get me cleared, he might be able to arrange a pardon. There'd be a good deal less danger in going back to Lallybroch then, you see."
"Well, yes, but..." He glanced sharply at me as I hesitated.
"What is it, Sasnach?"
I took a deep breath. "Jamie, if I tell you something, will you promise not to ask me how I know?" He took me by both arms, looking down into my face. The rain misted his hair, and small droplets ran down the sides of his face. He smiled at me.
"I told you that I wouldn't ask for anything that you didn't wish to tell me. Yes, I promise."
"Let's sit down. You shouldn't be standing on that foot so long." We made our way to the wall where the overhanging slates of the roof sheltered a small dry patch of pavement and settled ourselves comfortably, backs against the wall.
"All right, Sasnach. What is it?" Jamie asked.
"The Duke of Sandringham," I said. I bit my lip. "Jamie, don't trust him. I don't know everything about him myself, but I do know there's something about him. Something wrong."
"You know about that?"
He looked surprised. Now it was my turn to stare. "You mean you know about him already? Have you met him?" I was relieved. Perhaps the mysterious links between Sandringham and the Jacobite cause were much better known than Frank and the vicar had thought.
"Oh, aye. He was here visiting when I was 16. When I left."
"Why did you leave?" I was curious, remembering suddenly what Gillis Duncan had said when first I'd met her in the wood. The odd rumour that Jamie was the real father of Colm's son, Hamish. I knew myself that he wasn't, couldn't have been, but I was quite possibly the only person in the castle who did know. A suspicion of that sort could easily have led to Dougal's earlier attempt on Jamie's life. If, in fact, that's what the attack at Carriarrick had been. "It wasn't because of the Lady Letitia, was it?" I asked with some hesitation.
"Letitia?"
His startled astonishment was plain, and something inside me that I hadn't known was clenched suddenly relaxed.
I hadn't really thought there was anything to Gilly's supposition, but still. "What on earth makes you mention Letitia?" Jamie asked curiously. "I lived at the castle for a year and had speech of her maybe once that I remember, when she called me to her chamber and gave me the raw side of her tongue for leading a game of shinty through her rose garden."
I told him what Gilly had said, and he laughed, breath misting in the cool, rainy air.
"God," he said, "as though I'd have the nerve."
"You don't think Colm suspected any such thing, do you?" I asked.
He shook his head decidedly.
"No, I don't, Sasnach. If he had any inkling of such a thing, I wouldn't have lived to be 17, let alone achieve the ripe old age of 23.
This more or less confirmed my own impression of Colm, but I was relieved nonetheless. Jamie's expression had grown thoughtful, blue eyes suddenly remote.
"Come to think on it, though, I don't know that Colm does know why I left the castle so sudden then. And if Gillis Duncan is going about the place spreading such rumours, that woman's a troublemaker, Sasnach. A gossip and a scold, if not the witch folks say she is. Well, I'd best see that he finds out then.
He glanced up at the sheet of water pouring from the eaves.
Perhaps we'd best go down, Sasnach. It's getting a wee bit damp out.
We took a different way down, crossing the roof to an outer stairway that led down to the kitchen gardens, where I wanted to pull a bit of borage, if the downpour would let me. We sheltered under the wall of the castle, one of the jutting window ledges diverting the rain above.
"What do you do with borage, Sasnach?"
Jamie asked with interest, looking out at the straggly vines and plants beaten to the earth by the rain.
"When it's green, nothing. First you dry it, and then..."
I was interrupted by a terrific noise of barking and shouting coming from outside the garden wall. I raced through the downpour toward the wall, followed more slowly by Jamie, limping. Father Bain, the village priest, was running up the path, puddles exploding under his feet, pursued by a yelping pack of dogs. Hampered by his voluminous soutane, the priest tripped and fell, water and mud flying in spatters all around him. In a moment the dogs were upon him, growling and snapping. A blur of plaid vaulted over the wall next to me, and Jamie was among them, laying about with his stick and shouting in Gaelic, adding his voice to the general racket. If the shouts and curses had little effect, the stick had more. There were sharp yelps as the club struck hairy flesh, and gradually the pack retreated, finally turning and galloping off in the direction of the village. Jamie wiped the hair out of his eyes, panting.
"Bad as wolves," he said. "A dold column about that pack already. They're the ones that chased Coor into the loch 2 days ago. Best he has them short before they kill someone."
He looked down at me as I knelt next to the fallen priest, inspecting. The rain dripped from the ends of my hair, and I could feel my shawl growing sodden. "They haven't yet," I said. "Bar a few tooth marks, he's basically all right." Father Bain's soutane was ripped down one side, showing an expanse of hairless white thigh with an ugly gash and several puncture marks beginning to ooze blood. The priest, pasty white with shock, was struggling to his feet. Plainly he wasn't too badly injured.
"If you'll come to the surgery with me, Father, I'll cleanse those cuts for you," I offered, suppressing a smile at the spectacle the fat little priest presented, soutane flapping and argyle socks revealed.
At the best of times, Father Bain's face resembled a clenched fist. This similarity was made more pronounced at the moment by the red mottling that streaked his jowls and emphasized the vertical creases between cheeks and mouth. He glared at me as though I had suggested that he commit some public indecency. Apparently I had, for his next words were,
"What? A man no good to expose his personal parts to the handling of a woman? Well, I'll tell you, madam. I've no notion what sorts of immorality are practised in the circles you're accustomed to move in. But I'll have ye to ken that such'll no be tolerated here. Not so long as I've the cure of the souls in this parish."
With that, he turned and stumped off, limping rather badly, and trying unsuccessfully to hold up the torn side of his robe. "Suit yourself," I called after him. "If you don't let me cleanse it, it will fester." The priest didn't respond, but hunched his round shoulders and hitched his way up the garden stair a step at a time, like a penguin hopping up an ice floe. "That man doesn't care over much for women, does he?" I remarked to Jamie.
"Considering his occupation, I imagine that's as well," he replied. "Let's go and eat."
After lunch, I sent my patient back to bed to rest, alone this time, in spite of his protestations, and went down to the surgery. The heavy rain seemed to have made business slack. People tended to stay safely inside rather than running over their feet with ploughshares or falling off roofs. I passed the time pleasantly enough, bringing the records in Davy Beaton's book up to date. Just as I finished, though, a visitor darkened my door. He literally darkened it, his bulk filling it from side to side. Squinting in the semi-darkness, I made out the form of Alec McMahon, swathed in an extraordinary get-up of coats, shawls, and odd bits of horse blanket. He advanced with a slowness that reminded me of Colum's first visit to the surgery with me, and gave me a clue to his problem. "Rheumatism, is it?" I asked with sympathy as he subsided stiffly into my single chair with a stifled groan.
"Aye, the damp settles in my bones," he said. "Ought to be done about it."
He laid his huge, gnarled hands on the table, letting the fingers relax. The hands opened slowly, like a night-blooming flower, to show the calloused palms within. I picked up one of the knotted appendages and turned it gently to and fro, stretching the fingers and massaging the horny palm. The seamed old face above the hand contorted for a moment as I did it, but then relaxed as the first twinges passed.
"Like wood," I said.
"A good slug of whiskey and a deep massage is the best I can recommend. Tansy tea will do only so much." He laughed, shawl slipping off his shoulder.
"Whiskey? I had my doubts, lassie, but I see ye've the makings of a fine physician."
I reached into the back of my medicine cupboard and pulled out the anonymous brown bottle that held my supply from the Leoch distillery. I plunked it on the table before him with a horn cup. "Drink up," I said. "Then get stripped off as far as you think decent and lie on the table. I'll make up the fire so it will be warm enough." The blue eye surveyed the bottle with appreciation, and a crooked hand reached slowly for the neck.
"Best have a nip yourself, lassie," he advised. "It'll be a big job."
He groaned, with a cross between pain and contentment, as I leaned hard on his left shoulder to loosen it, then lifted from underneath and rotated the whole quarter of his body.
"My wife used to iron my back for me," he remarked, "for the lumbago. But this is even better. You've a good, strong pair of hands, lassie. Make a good stable lad, you would."
"I'll assume that's a compliment," I said dryly, pouring more of the heated oil and tallow mixture into my palm and spreading it over the broad white expanse of his back. There was a sharp line of demarcation between the weathered, mottled brown skin of his arms, where the rolled-up sleeves of his shirt stopped, and the milk-white skin of his shoulders and back.
"Well, you were a fine, fair laddie at one time," I remarked. "The skin of your back's as white as mine."
A deep chuckle shook the flesh under my hands.
"Never know now, would you? Aye, Ellen Mackenzie once saw me with my sark off, birthing a foal, and told me it looked like the good Lord had put the wrong head to my body. Should have had a bag of milk pudding on my shoulders instead of a face from the altarpiece."
I gathered he was referring to the rood screen in the chapel, which featured a number of extremely unattractive demons engaged in torturing sinners. "Ellen Mackenzie sounds as though she was rather free with her opinions," I observed. I was more than slightly curious about Jamie's mother. From the small things he said now and then, I had some picture of his father, Brian, but he had never mentioned his mother, and I knew nothing about her, other than that she had died young, in childbed.
"Oh, she had a tongue on her, did Ellen, and a mind of her own to go with it."
Untying the garters of his trews, I tucked them up out of the way and began operations on the muscular calves of his legs.
"But enough sweetness with it that no one minded much, other than her brothers. And she wasn't one to pay much heed to Colum or Dougal."
"Hmm. So I heard. Eloped, didn't she?" I dug my thumbs into the tendons behind his knee, and he let out a sound that would have been a squeak in anyone less dignified.
"Oh, aye. Ellen was the eldest of the six Mackenzie bairns, a year or two older than Colum, and the apple of old Jacob's eye. That's why she'd gone so long unwed. Wouldn't ha' aught to do with John Cameron or Malcolm Grant, or any of the others she might have gone to. And her father wouldn't ha' forced her against her will."
"When old Jacob died, though, Colm had less patience with his sister's foibles. Struggling desperately to consolidate his shaky hold on the clan, he had sought an alliance with Munro to the north or Grant to the south. Both clans had young chieftains who would make useful brothers-in-law. Young Jocasta, only 15, had obligingly accepted the suit of John Cameron and gone north. Ellen, on the verge of spinsterhood at 22, had been a good deal less cooperative.
"I take it Malcolm Grant's suit was rather firmly rejected, judging from his behaviour 2 weeks ago," I observed.
Old Alec laughed, the laugh turning to a satisfied groan as I pressed deeper.
I never heard exactly what she said to him, but I expect it stung. It was at the big gathering again that they met. Out in the rose garden they went, in the evening, and everyone waiting to see would she take him or no. And it grew dark, and they still waiting, and darker still, and the lanterns all lit, and the singing begun, and no sign yet of Ellen or Malcolm Grant.
Goodness, it must have been quite a conversation. I poured another dollop of the liniment between his shoulder blades, and he grunted with the warm pleasure of it.
So it seemed, but time went on and they didna come back, and Colm began to fear as Grant had eloped wi' her, taken her by force, you see. And it seemed as that must be the way of it, for they found the rose garden empty. And when he sent down to the stables for me, sure enough, I told him Grant's men had come for the horses, and the whole boiling of 'em gone awa' without a word of farewell.
Furious, 18-year-old Dougal had mounted his horse at once and set out on the track of Malcolm Grant, not waiting either for company nor for conference with Colm.
When Colm heard as Dougal had gone after Grant, he sent me and some others helter-skelter after him. Colm, being well acquaint with Dougal's temper, and not wishing to have his new brother-in-law slain in the road before the bands were called, for he reckoned as how Malcolm Grant, not being able to talk Ellen into wedding wi' him, must have taken her away in order to have his way wi' her, and force her into marriage that way.
Alec paused meditatively.
All Dougal could see was the insult, of course. But I dinna think Colm was that upset about it, to tell the truth, insult or no. It would have solved his problem, and Grant would likely have had to take Ellen wi'out her dower, and pay reparation to Colm as well.
Alec snorted cynically.
Colm is no the man to let an opportunity pass by him. He's quick, and he's ruthless, says Colm.
The single ice-blue eye swivelled back to regard me over one humped shoulder.
You'd be wise to bear that in mind, lassie.
I'm not likely to forget it, I assured him with some grimness. I remembered Jamie's story of his punishment at Colm's order, and wondered how much of that had been in revenge for his mother's rebellion. Still, Colm had had no chance to seize the opportunity of marrying his sister to the laird of Clan Grant. Toward dawn, Dougal had found Malcolm Grant camped along the main road with his followers, asleep under a gorse bush, wrapped in his plaid. And when Alec and the others had come pelting along the road some time later, they'd been stopped in their tracks by the sight of Dougal Mackenzie and Malcolm Grant, both stripped to the waist and scarred with the marks of battle, swaying and staggering up and down the roadway, still exchanging random blows whenever they got within reach of each other. Grant's retainers were perched along the roadway like a row of owls, heads turning one way and then the other, as the waning fight meandered up and down in the dripping dawn. They were both of them puffing like blown horses, and the steam rising off their bodies in the chill. Grant's nose was swelled to twice its size, and Dougal could scarce see out of either eye, and both with their blood dripping down and dried o'er their breasts. Upon the appearance of Colm's men, Grant's tacksmen had all sprung to their feet, hands upon their swords, and the meeting would likely have resulted in serious bloodshed, had some sharp-eyed lad among the Mackenzies not noted the rather important fact that Ellen Mackenzie was nowhere to be seen among the Grants.
Well, after they'd poured water on Malcolm Grant and brought him to his senses, He managed to tell them what Dougal wouldna pause to hear, that Ellen had spent but a quarter hour with him in the rose garden. He wouldna say what had passed between them, but whatever it was,